You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Homeland Report. We haven't had one of these for a while. I do want to remind people that if they do want to talk about their homeland and talk a bit about their history and what's going on and what the nationalist groups are doing over there in their home countries, then do drop us a line at stormersubs@hushmail.com, because we would like to do more of these Homeland Reports. It's always enjoyable to hear about white countries and a bit of a history from them, especially when it's being told by nationalists, because they're obviously going to be concentrating on the subjects that we find most interesting. And today we're going to return to Hungary. Now, the first Homeland Report we did from Hungary was very popular. It got a lot of comments, it got a lot of downloads. I even had people coming up to me when they met me for the first time and saying that they really enjoyed the Hungary report. So we're very pleased to welcome our Hungarian nationalist Berg back to the Homeland Report. So how are you doing today, Berg?
I'm fine, thank you. And what does your weather forecasting stone say in Wales?
It's a pretty good day today, actually, in Wales. It's a glorious day, actually. Lots of bright sunshine. It's a beautiful time of year, you know. Just lots of greenery. I know it's only going to be a few weeks until the leaves start falling. Probably my favourite time of year, actually. All the fruit is ripe. What's it like over there in Hungary?
It's basically the same. I also like the reddening of the leaves.
You're doing lots of grape gathering to wine making?
Yeah. We had a little vineyard, but we may just get back to it in the future.
Yeah, just from talking in the chat room, a lot of people, you know, in that part of the world seem to be making their own wine. It's not something we really do over here in Britain, because we don't have the right climate to grow the grapes.
It's the most natural thing in Hungary to grow your own wine and make your own wine.
Do you have a communal distillery that you use, that you hire out for making your wine?
People have their own cellars in the vicinity of the vineyards, and they had barrels there and all the stuff, the press in which they, you know, press the grapes. So they do it all by themselves.
And do they still do the pressing with their feet, the traditional way?
It's like a menu. There is a screw-like thing, and you push around the screw, and it slowly presses down the grapes.
Ah, right.
Not with feet anymore.
I was talking to someone the other day in the chat room. They still do it with their feet. It's fascinating learning this stuff.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Well, I believe the first thing that you wanted to bring to our attention was this TTIP. Is it the Transatlantic Treaty Partnership or something?
Yeah. So, have important news to impart. This has just came in. The TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is basically a would-be huge free trade deal, seems to be dead in the water. The French president told the European Commission to suspend negotiations because they, the French people, don't support it. The German economic minister said that the negotiations reached a dead end and that in the past 3 years there hasn't been one major issue upon which a settlement could be reached. The TTIP would have granted extraterritorial rights to multinational corporations. All debates between states and corporations would have to be settled on international courts. Huge, huge bureaucratic burden and waste of time and effort, if you ask me. The final verdict has not been said yet, but it's like 95% certain that it's dead in the water.
And that was quite a worry for you over there in Hungary. Why was that particularly?
Hungary is a relatively little state with little economy, so it's natural if we look at our predicament, I guess. But it was worryful for all the European Union because American corporations, which are quote-unquote American, would have endangered economic stability. And, when you put a lot of countries into free trade zones together, it's always a detriment to the local economy. So finally, to wrap up this TTIP thing, it's a win for the nation states and screw free trade.
Was there something else that Orbán would have stood to benefit from, the TTIP?
First of all, there's important thing a very few people seem to know, and that is that on April 6th, 2016, several Roma, that is, Gypsy organizations and local councils published an open letter in which letter they called out to all Gypsies in Hungary not to vote for Fidesz in 2018. They state that in 1990 the road opened before the Roma for the betterment of their future and they choose three people to advocate their interests in the public arena. And one of them was Viktor Orbán. They also noted, and I quote some selected passages, that Viktor Orbán started as a, quote, poor Roma kid, unquote, who turned his back on his people, spit the gypsies in the eye and stabbed them in the back. We also have a family photo from 1993 where we can see Orbán and his two brothers with their parents, and with the exception of the mother, they all betray revealing racial characteristics. Black hair, dark skin, buggy eyes, with Orbán being the relatively least gypsy looking. Thus, we can observe that Orbán is half gypsy heritage. By the way, his daughter, Rachel or Rahel in Hungarian, was named after a gypsy. They said it in a newspaper interview and totally looks like one. This was a few months ago and there has been no official response or denial anything from the government. It has been displayed on various media outlets, so the news is out there. And I find this whole issue absolutely extraordinary because previously Orbán's Roma heritage was rumored, but no specific evidence came to light. And this changes the picture.
So this is an official letter from the Roma saying that he is a gypsy. Well, how does that fit into the... because there's other evidence that shows that he's Jewish, isn't there?
There was rumors in the newspaper Le Monde. French newspaper wrote that, but there has been an official statement from the foreign ministry that he was confused with another member of the cabinet, Tomás Deutsch, or Tamás Deutsch in Hungarian, and he's evidently, I mean, everybody knows about him that he's Jewish, so the issue was settled.
Okay, so
that issue.
So do you think Orbán has been advocating for the gypsies?
I think Orbán's Roma heritage can be properly understood in the context of what he's been doing with his privatization stuff, or more precisely, he nationalizes things on power, then he gives them back to his circle of friends and clients and cronies. So the mindset of Orbán Viktor can be properly understood if we take into account this part of his history.
Are any of these cronies that he's been selling the industry off to, are any of them of gypsy heritage?
One of the closest to him, called Lőrinc Mészáros, has the looks of a Roma person, and he has been a gas man previously, you know, when your gas apparatus is broke, there come the gas man to fix it, and now he's a multi-billionaire because he got so many orders from the government to do this and that, and of course it has become an industry to rip off the EU for money that they give us to develop our infrastructure and or more to maintain our infrastructure, buildings and stuff like that. Hungary is the third most beneficiary when it comes to money received from the EU. So basically, it plays a major part why Viktor Orbán's government hasn't fallen yet. It's because they always have money to spend.
And of course, that would prevent him from actually leaving the EU.
Very good observation there. That's why Viktor Orbán never advocates leaving the EU. In fact, when Brexit happened, he stated that there would not be any Huxit while he's in power.
So he claims to be against the migrant invasion, and yet at the same time he wants to continue being a part of the EU and continue to get the money from the EU.
When it comes to the migrant invasion, it was the uproar of the people that motivated him to act. And he also realized that it's a very good target to aim at. Because when technically the migrants who came in went further to Austria and Germany, so Hungary was a transit country basically, and of course it posed great many problems. We talked about it in last episode, but the official rhetoric of the government is that migrants want to take Hungarians' jobs, which is obviously not the case.
Well, most of the Hungarians seem to move to Western and Northern Europe looking for work.
The most well-educated and well-trained, yeah. Because Orbán promised an economic miracle, basically, in 2010, and so far nothing has come out of it.
So what's the general public feeling towards Orbán and the Fidesz party, then?
The Hungarian political landscape is very fractured traditionally. It has been basically a two-party state with the Fidesz at the right, quote-unquote right, and the socialists at the left. And in 2006, the then-ruling socialist prime minister Ferenc Gyurcsány immolated himself when he talked about before his party about how everything they had done in the past years was totally a lie, and they lied to everyone, and all the statistical figures were false, and this created the mini revolution-like situation in Hungary back in 2007, and that was the beginning of the collapse of the two-party system, because the socialists fell out of the picture and the road was opened before other parties to emerge. And so Fidesz became the only ruling party, naturally. And so far, Viktor Orbán has everything in his power. He was elected by two-thirds majority in 2010. They have lost the majority since then. But they had the opportunity to enact any legislation they wanted. They have even rewritten the constitution. We have a new constitution since 2011, where basically all the cadres of Fidesz were granted 9, 11, and 12 years of terms to the posts that were created at that time.
So you got 9 or 11 years before the next chance to vote Fidesz out, is that correct?
Yeah, and to go even further than that, in many cases, if, let's say, the 12-year has passed, and if you don't have the two-thirds majority to elect another, then the guy whose term has passed is elected again, automatically.
Well, what do Jobbik think of this then? We haven't heard from the Jobbik party for a while.
Jobbik is, of course, everybody knows what the game is about. So it's like it's a common knowledge in Hungary that Fidesz wants to remain in power forever. The thing is that most people don't seem to be upset by it. And I would attribute this to the historical heritage of Hungary. Namely, that throughout the history of Hungary, there were several leaders who were ruling seemingly forever. For example, Franz Joseph, Austrian emperor, ruled for 68 years. Miklós Horthy, governor of Hungary, ruled for 25 years. János Kádár, the communist first secretary, ruled for 33 years. So Hungarians don't seem to be bothered in general about people who wants to rule forever.
And what do Jobbik say about that then? When did Jobbik arise? Did they come about in 2006 after this mini revolution?
Yeah. They were leading many protests against this this outrage, and they were of course beaten by police, chased from streets to streets, and this has created a huge sympathy towards them, because they were the underdog who were pestered totally without any reason. Let's say you have a national holiday And there are more policemen than the people who do the remembrance on the around the podium. So it was very unequivocally bad for the government. It was a PR mistake on their part to let loose the police on these good people who were just protesting the prime minister. And the police also beaten up people without any justification or reason, and that has fueled the anger even more.
Well, what have they said about this change in the constitution then? What have Jobbik said about that?
Jobbik protested many a times, and they totally denounced it as basically a power grab and something that is not in line with the principles of a democracy, that basically you elect people that you cannot be made to step down.
Jobbik, the opposition then, are they more powerful than this previous socialist party?
They were tied head to head for many a years, but and in the last few years they overtook the socialists. But now that Vona Gábor did a 180 turn, and I would like to talk about it in detail, the numbers don't seem to be show up that much.
So they're pretty much neck and neck with the socialists, but the Fidesz party have got the vast majority.
Yeah. The Fidesz party has around 2 million voters at the moment, with Jobbik and the socialists lagging behind around 1 million each.
Right, that's quite a difference there, isn't it? But at least I think, yeah. Jobbik have got have they got European Union members of parliament?
Yeah, Jobbik has three CMPs in the EU.
Well, what's the thing that you wanted to talk about with Gábor Vonár then?
The basic thing regarding the policy of Jobbik is that Gábor Vonár, the president of Jobbik, did a 180 turn with his intention that Jobbik should become a populist party instead of a radical one. As Andrew Anglin is always saying, and he's totally right, that in a harsher economic condition, the rhetoric should be more extreme too. Extreme times need extreme measures. But instead of doing that, Jobbik went soft and mellow. Vonár also excluded from the leadership those who voiced opinions different to his own and filled the post with his own men. Their numbers are in the last few months falling at the polls. This was in April. The time is ripe for a new nationalist party for emerge. So despite this bad thing, I consider this period a good one. Everything is in flux right now. Things will never go back to how they were. The time is ripe for nationalism.
So Vonár did pretty much the same as Orbán did then, and promoted his own cronies.
I wouldn't put it in that extreme way, but basically the crux of it is similar.
Well, how have Jobbik changed their policies then from what they were before?
They advocated unconditional leaving of the EU, and now they want to negotiate with the EU. And they wanted first unconditional leaving, now they want a referendum on it. So, which is not a bad thing in itself, but I have some doubts as to how truly they will advocate the leaving the EU position. whether a referendum should come.
I don't understand how a party that can claim to be a nationalist party can agree with being part of the European Union, which is internationalist by its very definition.
The EU monies, which can be spent to a lot of ways, probably play a major role.
It always does. This is why I was so proud of Wales when the majority of Wales voted to leave the European Union, because Wales had received the most money from the European Union out of all the regions in Britain. Wales had received the most, and yet the Welsh people still voted to leave the European Union. They put their children and their children's children, they put their needs ahead of their immediate materialistic needs for more money. Which is incredible, really, in this day and age that people do that. Yeah. It's
amazing.
So you think the time... Go on.
When it comes to Hungary, I would say that if there was to be a referendum like in the next week, it would be similar to Brexit, very close, but probably the exit position would win.
But Jobbik are no longer calling for... Are they calling for a referendum?
They say that in the event that they come to power, they will organize a referendum, but... And I guess I still believe them on that. I'm just not sure how strongly they will advocate leaving the EU, and it always matters that in the campaign approaching the referendum, in time there are campaigns, you know, leave or stay. And I'm not sure how harsh their rhetoric would be.
Well, you have got a sort of referendum coming up in October, haven't you? Although it's not on the European Union, is it?
It's about the quotas that are to be imposed to EU member states, and this is, as far as I understand, is not legally binding to the EU, of course, and it wasn't to be legally binding to the Hungarian parliament, because in case of legal binding, a new law has to be enacted in line with the referendum result. But now there are talks in the government that maybe we should make this referendum binding to the Hungarian parliament, which is, I think, is a realization that not many people interested in this half-hearted referendum, really. They view it for what it is. It's more of a PR solution of the government than an essential one or a substantial one.
I think it's not that necessary that it's legally binding. I know the referendum we had wasn't legally binding, but if the government then goes back on what the people have told them, then they're breaking all the rules of democracy, aren't they? Because they're supposed to be the servants of the people, and if the people make their voice heard, they make a decision, the people make a decision, then if the government are the servants of the people, they have to act on that decision, whether it's legally binding or not. There's no room for them to say the decision hasn't been made. I mean, it has been made. People have said what they want. So they have to go along with it. That's why the British government are going along with the Brexit vote, even though it wasn't legally binding, because it would go against all the very foundations of democracy to ignore that if the people have had that say. So I could see why they've done it that way. I don't think you would have anything to fear if the people voted no migrants, that Orban would not then write the new law saying no migrants. But it'd be interesting to see how Merkel responds to that, if she says, well, you can't write your own laws, you have to obey the EU instead.
Merkel is basically A lot of people see Merkel more for what she is, and I think she's a very weak person in many cases, and a sitting duck basically. So I don't think that Merkel would have anything substantial to say in this situation. And interestingly enough, because they would say something to the effect of, we have to respect the what the European Commission says, blah blah blah. But Germany isn't really doing that much. Basically, they open the gates. They are letting other people decide for them, the globalists that are really in power in Germany.
Well, what about this second fence that Orban is putting up? What was the need for this second fence? Is it a second fence within the original one, or is it a second fence somewhere else along your border?
Is it to augment the original one, mostly, overwhelmingly, and it has to be done because the migrants often pour through the original fence because it's of such low quality, and it's basically just not a barbed wire, but like a string of wires that can be uplifted, and the migrants can come through there. So I think he realized what a lousy job he'd done. So he and the in the Hungarian television and in state media, migrants are everywhere. Like every news is about a migrant, how he, you know, raped someone or robbed someone or whatever indignant thing he did. And he has to keep up the show, so to speak. Because everything is about migrants in state media. If you turn on the Hungarian television, 50% of the news, I guarantee you, would be about migrants, which is a good thing. I mean, not a bad thing, but there are more important issues than that now that the major influx has been successfully averted, because weak and faulty the fence it is, it keeps the migrants away, most of them.
Some of them are still getting through. Well, I would say possibly the fact that he now has to go and build another fence, I mean, that might also show his gypsy heritage. You know, if you're going to do a job, the first time. Do it right the first time. I did wonder why he was doing that, whether there was still a problem with the migrants in Hungary, because we haven't heard much about that. You're saying that it's all over the news there about the crimes that they're committing, but I haven't heard that over
the
here.
Crimes that they're committing in other countries, in Syria, Turkey, Germany. But there are some migrants, they number in the thousands or maybe a few tens of thousands. There are indeed Hungary, and they create some ruckus from time to time, because I think the government also needs migrants to be visible to some extent. So there could be fingers to point them at. See, that's the migrant.
To distract from the other things that Orban is doing.
Right.
All right, well, just to take it back to Jobbik then, you're saying that they've sort of softened what they were saying, because what they were saying before is that they wanted to be more allied with Russia than allied with America and the EU. So has their rhetoric changed as far as Russia is concerned and as far as America is concerned?
Gabor warned us foreign policies that there are three major centers in Europe that Hungary has to balance amongst. These three is Moscow, Istanbul, and Berlin. So Jobbik's foreign policy was balanced from the start, but it hasn't changed. Jobbik is friend to Russia as far as Russia is advocating nationalist interests in Europe.
Right.
Gábor Vona even participated in Lomonosov University, where he was invited by Alexander Dugin, the then court philosopher of the Kremlin. I know it's a caricaturization, but Dugin was certainly close to Putin at that time. But what I'm hearing is that he fell from grace since then. But so it's Dugin advocates the so-called Eurasianism, which is about the Eurasian Union, which would be a union between Asia and Europe. It's like an economic community. And Putin still advocates that, so that hasn't changed. And Hungary, the Jobbik made some overtures to it, that it would be better than being part of the European Union to be part of the Eurasian Union. So that's their official standing as far as I know.
So they support Dugin's ideology then?
To the extent that it's about nationalism, or to the extent that it achieves nationalist results.
What do you think of this Eurasian Union then? You say it's an economic union. Wouldn't that be a bit similar to this TTIP partnership, but just with Russia and Asia instead of with America and the European Union?
Basically, what we have to understand here is that in all economic union, there is one major power that takes advantage of all the others. In Europe, it is Germany and France. In the Eurasian Union, it would be Russia. So the question becomes then, to what extent are we, do we like this dominance of Russia? And there certainly would be some economic opportunities, but the thing is here that Russia is pretty dominant when it comes to advocating its own interests. So it's something to be wary of, I guess, or aware of at least.
Well, I think Hungary would be wary of Russia anyway after being occupied by the Soviets.
That's true, but the times have changed, and interestingly, the people are not anti-Russian, not that anti-Russian at all. When it's about news about Putin, how he represents his own people, it is always very favorably received by the Hungarian people. On forums, there are always much more upvotes under Putin news than downvotes.
So there's a lot of support for Putin in Hungary then?
We look at him as a sympathetic guy, which means that Putin is doing a very good job selling himself as a nationalist. But that's for another time, I guess.
Well, I think you wanted to talk a little bit about Russia, didn't you? Do you want to talk a bit about Russia here?
Yeah. I think its subject is worth talking about because there are recurring myths when it comes to Putin, and it's useful to dispel one or two. A lot of Western commentators seems to misunderstand Putin. The major underlying rationale that the Putin regime or the media thereof employs is that, quote, we fought against fascism, so everyone who's against this is a fascist, unquote. In that light, everybody can be a fascist. Even Obama is portrayed in the Russian media occasionally as fascist. They of course know that Obama is anything but fascist and it goes against common sense, but that is how the Russian media portrays everyone who stands against Putin in any ways. One of the latest examples of when it comes to Putin, Western commentators seem to miss one or two facts is this article from January 2016 on The Deformer, which quotes Putin as saying that Lenin put an atomic bomb under Russia. And the one most important thing that we have to understand about this is that there was a thing called the Constitution of the USSR, the Communist Soviet Union. In that constitution, there was a paragraph that permitted the states that came together to form the Union to exit the Soviet Union. And this clause or paragraph was added by Lenin for federalist persuasions at the time. And this was the legal pretense for several states under which they left Russia in 1991 upon the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And this was the time bomb Putin was referring to, that the federal republics that entered the Soviet Union were permitted by the constitution to leave it. So Putin didn't criticize Lenin for his ideology, he was criticizing it for a technicality he did. The long and short of this is Lenin, quote, Lenin did good things, but there was this one thing he screwed up among many. And Putin is from time to time employing the rationale that everybody would have realized sooner or later what a fantastic idea communism is, so the repressions were unneeded and harmful. Again, there's a technicality here. And he employs also another rationale that communism was a good idea in principle, it was just practically unachievable, unreachable and unsustainable. So it turned out ultimately to be a bad thing, but it was a very noble intention. And Putin regularly talks about this. So it's more like anything, a technicality, right? He's not criticizing for communism for what it really is, a cult of death and a total satanic form of state, total repression. But he criticized it, it was noble, but, you know, human nature is faulty, so we couldn't achieve it.
Well, I think really true equality can only come through ethnicity. If you're equal in ethnicity, then it doesn't matter what class you are, and that's nationalism. So communism could never work if it was international. I think maybe he's looking at that clause and saying that was a mistake that Lenin made.
That was out of
wishing to have a big empire, basically, and it all fell apart, which caused the Russians to be in extreme poverty for quite some time. It was dreadful when the Soviet Union actually fell for a lot of people.
Right.
So I think maybe he's referring to the suffering of the people there.
Yes, and if only Lenin didn't add or hadn't add this clause to the constitution, it would have been much, much better, which I agree. But these are nationalist principles upon which states left the Soviet Union in 1991 in the first place. So,
well, it's interesting that you say that, you know, he's a nationalist, but at the same time, you know, he still has these sort of desires for empire and federation.
Yes, because I think that Putin's quote-unquote nationalism are the side effects of his imperial thinking, that he's thinking in empire. Of course, he advocates the betterment of the Russian people, no doubt about that. But Russia has many, many nationalities. It has always had. So it comes with the territory that he has to cater to many nationalities at the same time. And I'm not even blaming him for this particular thing. It's just the nature of Russia as it is.
Well, this is the difference, I think, because we have different nationalities in Britain. You know, we have Welsh, Scottish, Northern Irish, English, and yet we all come together as British. But that's because we're all one ethnicity. The difference with Russia is that you've got different ethnicities that make up part of the Russian Federation, haven't you?
Well, you have the Mongolian type of people. You have some Arab type of people, not many, but you have very, very many Muslims. Moscow has the biggest Muslim community in all of Europe.
Yeah, but at least he called that big mosque the Cathedral Mosque. I mean, he was letting them know who was in charge. You know, Russia is a Christian country. We're going to call it the Cathedral Mosque.
Yeah, and this mosque was a reinstitution of an old mosque that was either destroyed or fallen out in disrepair and was demolished. So technically he didn't build a new mosque to the Muslims in Moscow.
Well, what about the Jews in Russia? I mean, I know that he got rid of a lot of the oligarchs. And what about the ones in Hungary? Do you still see a Jewish oligarchy in Hungary and in Russia?
There are certainly entrenched Jewish interests in Russia, but I would like to raise an issue that is very interestingly ties in with the migrant crisis, the fence. And this is that despite the anti-migrant rhetoric, there are a lot of Gulf states investors and businessmen buying property in Budapest, the capital of Hungary. In the recent past, a famous palace in Budapest, the Drexler Palace, was acquired by a certain Hamad bin Jassim bin Jaber Al Thani from Doha. The Intercontinental Budapest Hotel was acquired by a certain Khalaf al-Habtur. Kadem al-Kubaisi wants to acquire the so-called Paris Yard, and the most famous example is a certain Gate Pharaon, who bought several castles, hotels and other real estate, and he has connection with the Al-Qaeda and is wanted by the FBI. So that ties back, that just came into my mind, that ties back that despite the anti-migrant rhetoric, Viktor Orban is more than happy to conduct deals with these Gulf state and Arab and Saudi investors. But the Jews also travel in real estate, primarily in Hungary. And this is particularly painful because, as I said, all of the, I didn't got to mention this, but Viktor Orban's government so far has privatized most of the state lands, these arable lands that were state property in Hungary to at biddings. And these biddings were conducted behind closed doors, and nobody from outside could enter. And there are suspicions that a lot of Israeli investors could get their dirty hands on Hungarian land. And it's there's other facets to it, because it will result the creation of big latifundia. How do you call when you have more than 1,000 hectares under you? That's a big land, right?
Yeah, conglomerate farms.
Yeah, these big farms. And Of course, in nowadays, a few tractors are enough to toil the land and to reap the harvest. So it would result people flocking in the cities, which is already happening in mass scales.
It would also deprive the small farmers from their subsistence, and instead they'd all be working for the Jews. So it's not just a problem with Jews buying things up; it's now also a problem with these Arabs buying everything up.
Yeah. Despite all the rhetoric of Viktor Orban.
Well, I think you also wanted to talk about St. Thomas Aquinas's way of dealing with the Jews.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that for a bit?
Yeah. How to handle your Jew according to traditional Catholic teaching. There is a Hungarian Catholic thinker and traditionalist called Péter Szász, who wrote an article about Jews and how we should handle them in accordance with traditional Catholic teaching. I would like to convey his viewpoints on this subject. The Duchess of Brabant wrote a letter to Thomas Aquinas, then the undisputed expert on religious and legal matters, inquiring as to handling the Jew. Saint Thomas responded in the following vein. There are four main points here. First, Jewry wanders in the world like Cain, who must not and cannot be killed. God will maintain Jewry so that he could show his power over them eventually. This wandering is the big question mark and the big exclamation mark evidence for Christ against the Jews' will. Whatever the devil does, he only carries the brick from which God's city will be built. The Jews fell so that God can turn it to an even greater good. So here we could realize that we are helpless without God. Anything to add?
Well, I just find it interesting that they draw a parallel between the Jew and Cain, the son of the wicked one.
Yeah. Second, the Jewry in its punishment cannot dissolve among the nations. They cannot find peace. The wall between Jew and non-Jew cannot be torn down, neither by Marxism nor by liberalism. Here it just came to mind that there are two sacred walls in Jewish mythology. The wall in Jerusalem and Wall Street in New York. But that's just my observation. Therefore the Jew feels as an alien everywhere. Therefore the Jew cannot be allowed to practice usury, to take interest on loans, because that is what created its power base in the modern world. This is how they rule over us. The current system of lending and credit is in their hands. They cannot be allowed to direct the financial system of a country. It's the nation's responsibility to see this end. The chains of the slavery of usury have to be broken. Of course, the angelic doctor, that was the nickname of Saint Thomas Aquinas, demands sanctions against non-Jewish usurers as well. Third, no offices can be sold to them. Moreover, we can't get indebted to them. The movie characters of the Jutsus and other infamous Jew characters are not anti-Semitic but anti-Goy. They expose the leaders of the non-Jews, because the Jew only does what he does. This is how it was in the 17th, 18th, 19th century. History is the teacher of life. There is a lesson to be learned there. In the Jutsus, the prince is at least as a culprit as the Jew. The prince is only interested in eating, having fun, chasing skirts, and that is how the Jew can get close to him. Generally, Jews shower the aristocrats with money, lavish gifts, they throw parties for them, they organize balls for them. You know what a ball is.
Yes.
Right? For those who may not, ball is an event when aristocrats gather and they dance and they are having fun. And that's how they ingratiated themselves with the elite. Fourth, after the Jews are forced to have decent jobs, their separation needs to be sanctioned too. They can't get equal citizenship with the host population. They have to live in the land as persons directly subservient to the state, and all this thanks to the patience of the government. But they have to have different living quarters and different clothing to non-Jews. This is not external pressure, this is prescribed in the Torah. Their own writings demand this. So they have to live in different neighborhoods, wear different clothes, and the government can expel them if they abuse the patience of the state.
That, I believe that's also called Sikkit Judaeus Non, which is what Professor E. Michael Jones talks about.
Yeah, that's what Dr. Michael E. Jones advocates, albeit I doubt that he spells it out to the detail this much as I do.
Yeah, he breaks it down to you cannot harm the Jew, but at the same time, the Jew cannot harm you. And the way that the Jew can harm you is through usury, and he has to be kept separate. And obviously, there's more details to that there. And when he says that you cannot harm the Jew, I mean, obviously, if the Jew does harm, you have to defend yourself against him. But what he's saying is that just for him being a Jew, he shouldn't be stuck on the bonfire. Or impaled.
But
on
you
the
have
stake.
You can expel them if they abuse the patience of the state.
Yes, and they're only there at the generosity of the state and of the host people.
Yeah, and all this is about that there has to be a legal decision. So I think the overlying motive is that when pogroms happen, they never get the true people responsible, the true Jews responsible for the Gentile demise, because they escape and it's incidental who gets to get caught and whatever. So there has to be a legal framework in which we can judge them
and remove them.
If they abuse our generosity.
And there haven't been any pogroms for centuries, really, have there?
Yeah. But in the Middle Ages, they happened.
And they seem to have forgotten that they're here only at our generosity. They've completely forgotten that and think they deserve to be here, and they deserve to be running things and in the government.
Yes, precisely. If they are at our behest.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. They're only here at our behest. That's probably the word that I was looking for. I often get stuck for words and start repeating myself with that. You know, that's good to hear that was the official Catholic Church's teaching on that. And yet, thanks to Vatican II, they've completely changed all of that and are now trying to claim that anti-Semitism is a sin, criticizing the Jews is a sin, that the Jews weren't guilty for killing Christ. The Jews don't even have to ask for forgiveness of sins, according to the Pope. They have a previous dispensation. I mean, the Catholic Church has turned everything completely on its head. Do you still have traditionalist Catholics over there in Hungary, Berg? Do you have a traditionalist Catholic priest that's speaking out against the Muslim invasion at all?
We have a so-called mainline Catholics, well, at least not Sede Vacantists of what I know, but we have several bishops who raised their voice against the Muslim invasion of Europe, and they even formulated some criticism towards the Pope, who has to be of, I don't know, some communist mindset here.
I think I read about one of them.
It was the Bishop of Szeged and the Bishop of Veszprém or Győr, something like that. There were several bishops, that's for sure.
And that's very brave of them and courageous of them to speak against what the Pope is doing, don't you think?
And also the bishop has more authority or a little bit more of a freedom of speaking his mind. The simple parish priest can be silenced by the bishop.
Well, it's good to hear that at least there is still some resistance in the Catholic Church, and most of it is in the east of Europe, Poland and Hungary. I'd like to finish on something positive, if we may, Berg. That's quite positive enough as it is, really, that these Catholic priests are speaking out against this. But I believe your media, your publications there, you seem to have more free speech than we do, with this journalist, Zsolt Bayer, is that his name, that was recently given an award, and the Jews were furious about this, is that right?
His first name is pronounced Zsolt Bayer, and... He got a journalistic award, and he's created upward several Jews who were similarly received the medal, and at previous years or before Orban came to power, but when Orban was in power. So Orban is not really discriminatory towards Jews. We have to establish this. They gave back their medals in protest that we don't take up any community with this person. And the thing we have to understand about Zsolt Bayer is that he's very, very fiercely anti-Jobbik and very servile in his conduct towards the Fidesz party, but he also happens to have some common sense views about the gypsies mainly. Not that much about the Jews, and I can talk about this, but one of the essays was that whenever you see a gypsy kid on the street approaching you, pedal to the metal. And that was in response because in a few years back there was a gypsy family who lynched a car driver in Olaszliska, it's a small village, because the driver almost hit a child. He didn't hit the child, he grazed the child, but the child has suffered no injuries whatsoever, but the family lynched him to death. And that is what he was referring to. By the way, he thinks this Zsolt Bayer that communism and fascism are the same, and there were, and I'm just referring to this, there were death camps in Germany. So all this stuff. But it's faulty to an extent, but nevertheless, it's an example against the Jews and against the voices of political correctness. It's a standing.
So he's mainly supported because he supports Fidesz then?
Yeah.
That's why Orban supports him. But it's good to hear that these Jews are handing their medals back. I should imagine maybe that played a part in these gypsies writing that letter saying that they're disowning Viktor Orban.
Medal thing with Zsolt Bayer was maybe a week ago, and the gypsy letter was on the 6th of April.
Ah, right. So different time.
Little more while back.
Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up before we finish?
Nothing in particular. Hail victory.
Hail victory indeed. Thank you very much for coming on, Berg, and hopefully we'll hear from you again in the future if you have some more items of importance that you'd like to tell us. And again, if people wish to record a homeland report with me, then just get in touch, send an email to stormersalves@hushmail.com or find Radio Arian on Twitter and send me a message there, or leave something in the comments, because we really would like to record some more homeland reports. Just people talking about their nations and what's going on there, especially with the invasion of Europe at the moment, and also what the nationalist scene is like. So thanks again for coming on, Berg, and thank you, listeners, for listening, and keep listening to Radio Arian.
Abban lakik egy madár, túl a vizen egy kosár, abban lakik egy madár, abban lakik egy madár, aki engem rég hogy vár, abban lakik egy madár, aki engem rég hogy vár. Este hozzád megyek már, várj madárkám, várj, 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 este hozzád megyek már, megvizsgálom szívedet, véle szeretetedet, megvizsgálom szívedet, véle szeretetedet. Zörgős malom, ott őröl az ingalambom, túl a vizen, zörgős malom, ott őröl az ingalambom, ott egy ebet nem őröllek, csak kúcs bánatot eleget, ott egy ebet nem őröllek, csak kúcs bánatot eleget. Nékem is van egy bánatom, oda viszem, lejáratom. Nékem is van egy bánatom, oda viszem, lejáratom. Egy szem búza, kettő rozs, felöntöttem, járja most. Egy szem búza, kettő rozs, felöntöttem, járja most. Istenem, halálom, nem ér engem az álom. Én Istenem, halálom, nem ér engem az álom. Mert az álom nyugodalom, s a szerelem szívfájdalom. Mert az álom nyugodalom, s a szerelem szívfájdalom. Teremtőm, de beteg a én Istenem, teremtőm, ne beteg a szeretőm. Ja Istenem, gyógyítsd meg, harmadnapra fulladd meg. Ja Istenem, gyógyítsd meg, harmadnapra fulladd meg.